Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
The CDs The Shmooze 99 is sponsored by Dr. and Mrs. Yaakov Orbach and Pinchas Orbach. Welcome back. L'zeich nishmas, their grandfather, Reb Yosef ben Reb Yaakov. When the Pasuk describes the way the various kelim in the Mishkan were formed, the Torah goes into great length in terms of the detail of their constructions, what materials they were manufactured from, and there are a number of details that don't seem to need to be included, yet they are. And the Pasuk in Perek Lamed Ches in Shmos Pasuk Ches says, Vayas is a kior. They made the wash basin. The wash basin was the area, was a place where the Kohanim would wash their hands and their feet before they went into the Ohel Moed. Vayasa Sakir, the wash basin was made nechoshes from copper. Veskano nechoshes, the base that it stood on was made of copper. Vimaros hatzavos, with the mirrors of the multitudes. Ashetzavu Pesach Ohel Moed, that were gathered in the Ohel Moed. So this wash basin was made of copper from these mirrors of the multitudes. Now it's clearly not obvious what these mirrors of the multitudes refers to. What are these mirrors? So Rashi on the Pasuk explains to us, Benos Yisrael hayu biyodam maros. The Jewish women had these mirrors in their hands, sheroz bahen, that they would look into, kishemis kashos, when they would beautify themselves. V'yaf osom lo ikful melahavi, and even these they did not withhold from bringing the nedavas of Mishkan, to give it as a contribution to the Mishkan. Via Moes Moshe Bohen. And Moshe Rabbeinu found them disgusting. He felt it was abhorrent to give these type of kelim to the Mishkan. Why? Because the purpose of these mirrors were to make a woman more attractive. When a woman's more attractive, that's a way of enticing other men. That's a way of enticing the Yetzer. Hence, Moshe Rabbeinu did not want to use these mirrors in the Mishkan because he felt it was inappropriate. Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said to him, Kabel, accept them. Ki elu chavivim alai min hakol, because these mirrors are more precious to me than any of the other contributions. Why? Shal yedehem imidu nashim tzavos rabos, because with these mirrors, the women establish multitudes of people. What was the story? Hashem went on to say, Kishubalim yegeim bavodas perach, the Jewish men in Mitzrayim were made to work very, very long, hard hours. They would be made to sleep in the fields. The women would go out to their husbands. They would bring with them machol mishta. They'd bring out food and drink. They would give their husbands food to eat, something to drink. The notlos amaros, these women would take these mirrors with them. Each woman would hold up the mirror in front of herself and in front of her husband. She would attempt to seduce him with words. She would say, I'm more beautiful than you are. Meaning as if to say, look in the mirror, pay attention to my beauty. Via this, they would bring their husbands to desire. Their husbands would be with them. From those unions, they became pregnant. And they would give birth. In fact, the legions, the many, many children who sang Shir Aliyam were born from these events. Hence Hashem said, not only aren't these mirrors disgusting to me, not only aren't they most, the opposite. Chavivin alai, these are literally the most precious of all the nedavas. These are the ones that I wish for more than anything else. And this is the maros atzavos, the mirrors of the multitudes, referring to the multitudes of children that were born with these mirrors. And in fact, Hashem said these are the most precious of all the nedavas. And the only thing I think that's slightly difficult to understand about this Rashi is that at this point, Moshe Rabbeinu was on the highest level of Nevuah. Moshe Rabbeinu at this point was a Navi who saw Bath Baklaria HaMe'ira with a total clarity of vision. He understood Torah. He understood Das Torah greater than any human being who ever lived and who ever will live. And yet it seems that Moshe Rabbeinu was so far off that he was on the exact opposite extreme of what Hashem felt. Moshe Rabbeinu looked at these as abhorrent, as disgusting. How could you accept this in the Mishkan? Not only doesn't Hashem say, no, it's okay, Hashem says the opposite. Chavivin, these are the most precious. And I think the question begs being asked, how is it possible that Moshe Rabbeinu, with his great wisdom, with his great understanding of Das Torah, could be so far off that Hashem says, mamish, the opposite. Not only aren't these disgusting, these are the most precious. And the question is, how can Moshe Rabbeinu be so far off of the correct Das Torah? And to answer this question, I'd like to take a little bit of a tour this evening of things that we don't often discuss, but you'll excuse me for spending some time on it. A little while ago, my wife said to me that our daughter, who's now a senior in high school, told her that some of her friends didn't come to school that day because they were having a DMC. Now, I didn't know what a DMC was, but I was rightly curious. So, and especially considering the fact that these girls missed school because of a DMC. So I, in fact, asked my wife, what is a DMC? And I found out, a DMC is a deep, meaningful conversation. It's where two girls talk and they share their inner thoughts, they share their feelings, and they communicate on a very deep and meaningful level. And these girls were involved in a DMC, and hence they didn't come to school because they're up so late. Now, the reason why this is relevant is because I taught high school boys for 15 years. Not one time in 15 years did I ever hear of two guys staying late up at night sharing their inner thoughts and conversing and how do you feel and just bonding together. It just never happened in 15 years of teaching high school. One more quick observation. I have another daughter who's 14 years old. She decided she was going to have a sleepover with a friend. The only thing is, my wife said to her, it's a school night, you are not having a sleepover. My daughter's a bit resourceful. They decided they're going to have a sleepover each in their own home. How would they manage to do this? They picked up the phone and they spoke for 5 hours straight. 5 hours straight, they spoke on the phone. Ribbono d'olam kulo, what do you talk about for 5 hours? Now, when you realize that there are differences between boys and girls, when you study the differences, you start recognizing that young boys and young girls, and later on men and women, are starkly different one from the other. The way they behave, the way they relate, the way they communicate, their interests, their desires, what matters to them, their very value system are very different. I'll give you another interesting illustration. When I was a bocher in yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva was very much makbid on godless adam, and that was our mesorah. And I remember that if a guy would come to Seder without his hair combed, it was considered like a chasorin in his, you know, come on, you should be a mensch, you should comb your hair. There are many yeshivas where that's not so stressed. In fact, there are many yeshivas in New York where you will not find a mirror, not because by accident, but you won't find mirrors in the bathrooms, nor will you find them in the dorm, because that's considered gashmias, it's considered too much focused. Now, that's an interesting approach. My Mesorah, my Reshiva holds is a different approach, is godless Adam, but either approach is probably okay for a guy in yeshiva. If you would go to a Beis Yaakov, anywhere in this country, anywhere in the world, and one of the machaneches would say, I don't want you girls looking in a mirror before you come to school, I would say that that's unnatural and dangerous to the girl's development. Because it is very important to a girl that she be attractive. It's part of the essence, part of the nature of a young woman that she needs to feel good about herself, and by being attractive, that makes her feel good. And if you stymie that, if you try to stifle that natural instinct, likely you're going to damage her development. Now, you may say to me that it's true. There are differences between boys and girls, men and women, but much of that is culturally learned, it's conditioning, it's acquired behaviors. I'd like to share with you a study that's very illustrative. Psychologists did a study of three-year-olds. They went into various GANs, little, you know, typical little daycare centers, and they studied three-year-olds. And what they found was that the boys and the girls would play, and boys and girls were best friends typically 50% of the time. Meaning a boy would have a girl as a best friend, a girl would have a boy. About 50-50, they played equally well. The same study done with five-year-olds found that only 20% of the friendships were cross-gender. Meaning now, boys with a best friend who's a girl, girls with a best friend who are boys were only 20%. By the time these children were 7 years old, the number reached zero. They did not find a single example of a boy who said his best friend was a girl, nor a girl who said his best friend was a boy. And they found that this continued up until puberty, up until the age when there was some maturity, and then things reverted back to the previous numbers. Now, would you like to know why that is? I think it's rather obvious. A three-year-old has very little gender identity. A three-year-old is a kid. Kids play with kids. It's all the same. Short hair, long hair, dresses, skirt, doesn't make a difference. By the time the children have reached 5 years old, their identity is formed, and a boy is starkly different than a girl. Now, physically, they still look the same, but boys are into the boy type of activities, girls are into the girl type of activities, and they don't play the same games. By the time they're seven, they have no shaykhis one to another. They're in total different worlds. Their interests are different, the way they play are different, and they've studied. Typically, the way girls play is very different than the way boys play. When a girl falls down on the ball field, they all stop, and there's great interest in picking her up and making sure she's okay. The same story when a boy falls, hey, get out of the way, guy, we're trying to play a game. They act differently, they relate differently, they communicate differently, they behave differently. The whole essence of the being are different. And if you study men and you study women, you find that they are starkly different to the extent that they almost look like two different species. A Gemara that my Rosh Hashiva, that my Rebbe quoted very often, it's a Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Samach Beis Amud Aleph, Noshim Am Bifnei Atzmam, women are a nation unto themselves, meaning the innate differences between men and women are so strong that they are literally as if they are from different planets, different species, they're very real different types of people. And that presents a rather interesting challenge. How do you take two people who are innately, by their very, in their very essence, different, and bring them together to live in peace and harmony? What happens when the Chosan and Kala, 6 weeks ago they didn't know each other, they met, they were introduced, and now they're expected to live happily ever after? But let me make the problem a little bit more clear. You're not just dealing with a man and a woman who are different in their essence, in their nature. You're dealing with totally different upbringings. He was brought up in his home. In his home, there was a particular way of doing things. There was a way of relating. There was a whole lifestyle that his family inculcated in him. She was brought up in a very different household with different, very different values, with different ways of doing things. You're taking people from different lifestyles who are innately completely different. They have different beliefs, different values, different ways of communicating, different ways of their modus operandi are different. You're asked to put them together, and in an instant, they're supposed to live together in peace and harmony in the closest of all human relations. They're supposed to share their lives together. And it's supposed to work. Now, if you think about it, by all logic, it should never work. There should never be a concept of a man and a woman living together in peace and harmony. They're so different, there should naturally be at odds. There should be no such concept. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted man and woman to live together. So Hashem put a number of features in the world to allow a husband and wife to bond together. The first of those features is something called infatuation. Now, infatuation is the thing that you see when the chassan gets that starry-eyed look like, he's glass. He doesn't even see you. I've seen big masmin. I love in yeshiva. You see the big masmin. The guy's learning, starts going out. A couple of dates later, he's looking at the Gemara, and the Gemara's looking at him. He's looking at the Gemara, and the Gemara's looking at him, and you know he's gone. La la land. Whoa, yeah. And he looks up. He's got that little high look, and you know it's over. It's over. He is gone. Now, I want you to hear what I'm saying here. That is a certain koach, a certain force that Hashem put into the heart of man, in the heart of woman. And I view it almost as if there's a capsule. Almost imagine that there's a capsule in the heart of man that breaks open. Boy meets girl, the capsule breaks open, and a flood of euphoria just swamps his brain. The drug just spreads, and he goes into la-la land. Now, in this state, there are marked real differences in his behavior. He could be a grumpy, ornery guy, and he's all smiles and everything is great, and he'll act very differently in that state. You hear all kinds of strange things. Guys go up to the roof and they start singing. La 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 la. What are you? You're the most sober, rational, serious guy you ever met, and he starts acting in a very irrational manner. And in fact, if you study chassanim and kalas, they do things that are a bit funny. And I'll share with you something personally. When I was engaged, now let me preface this. My wife is one sharp cookie. She is a very, very on the ball individual. And we had just been recently engaged, and she looked at me and she said these words. I know it's not true, and I know it can't be, but you're perfect. You're perfect. Now understand, I'm thinking to myself, oh boy, she's got a lot to learn. I'm not telling her this. I will not be the one to inform her, but she's in for a bit of a rude awakening. But she said these words. And gentlemen, I want you to hear what I'm saying here. Would you like to know why it is that the Kala thinks the Chosen is perfect, and the Chosen thinks the Kala is perfect? She's gorgeous, the most beautiful woman you've ever, I can't even describe. And you see, she's nice. Well, you know, okay, but you know, like, Pshat is quite simple. Hashem wanted the young man and the young woman to attach one to another. But because they are so starkly different, because they come from such different backgrounds, because they have such a different nature, there needs to be a certain thing to help that bond. Hashem created this thing called infatuation, called falling, calling, I call it again almost this capsule that sort of goes off in the chest. It spreads, and that sense of euphoria, that drug spreads, and now everything is perfect. The fact that he's late is okay. The fact that he's sloppy, it's all right. The fact that she's what, it doesn't matter. It's okay. And in that state, they're both able to overlook each other's imperfections. They're both able to adapt to each other's different ways, and they're able to begin their marriage in a proper, happy, beautiful, loving manner. Now, if you ask anyone who's married for more than 10 years, and especially if they're married for more than 20 years, was that state real? They'll laugh at you. It's not even puppy love. It's just whatever, infatuated, just a little thing. The objective is for there to be a real bond. The real bond means an attachment, a love, a deeply rooted bond of love between husband and wife. The infatuation stuff is cute, and it's a necessary tool to get you to the first level of acceptance, the first level of living in peace and harmony, so that after years of sharing life together, years of bringing a family together, bringing your existence one to another, caring for another, you build a true bond of love, and a bond of love that really has mamushas, has substance to it. I had a chance to speak to a gentleman very recently. He was at a family simcha. Nachman Son, he's in a wheelchair. He had a stroke 3 years ago. And he said to me a very sad line. I was speaking with him. His entire left side is paralyzed. He said, I used to be the head of my family. I'm not anymore. And at that point, I'm almost breaking into tears. And then he said this line to me. He points to his wife. His wife was off in the distance. We were sitting alone talking. You see her? She's great. She is so great. For the past 3 years, I can't move. I can't do anything. She takes care of me. She does everything for me. She is great. Now, gentlemen, I want you to hear this. That is dedication. That is devotion. And that is a manifestation of love. If after 40 years of marriage, the wife says, you are my husband, you are a stroke victim, I will do whatever I need to do to help you, and she knows that there's no cure in sight, but she's devoted and dedicated to helping and totally, totally moser her entire nefesh for this person, that's a manifestation of true love. That does not happen when the chassan goes, whoa, and the caliph goes into la-la land. That type of infatuation that you see when boy meets girl is just the tool to begin the long, difficult process of building real love. And interestingly enough, the infatuation is something that quickly passes. At this point, I may have mentioned this recently, but it's Daniel Goleman's observation that current marriages are no longer at the 50% divorce rate. Because 50% divorce means if you take the marriages across the full gamut of ages, 50% of marriages currently end in divorce. If you take the current marriages, meaning people who are getting married today, the odds of getting divorced are about 67%. 67% of the couples who look into each other's eyes, stand by the altar and say, until death do us part, will be divorced within 2 years, maximum 5 years. And what you quickly discover is that love, that infatuation, quickly passes. You see, it is a tool, a very powerful tool to get the couple to the next stage. But the next stage is true devotion, true dedication, love, and real bonding. But if you're going to rely on the infatuation to be the end-all and be-all of your marriage, you will find yourself in very serious trouble. And it's a rather unusual thing, but the human makes some interesting mistakes. Ask the typical 15-year-old boy, what's going to happen when it's time? Oh, when it's the right time, I'm going to meet my Basharit, my soulmate, the one who's destined to me, and I'm going to love her, she's going to love me, we're going to live happily ever after. Even though his own parents' marriage may be a dismal failure. Even though he may be a troubled personality. Even though he has great difficulty in getting along with anybody, he sincerely believes she'll love me, I'll love her, and it'll be peace and harmony forever and ever. Well, guess what? Rarely does it work that smoothly. Rarely is it that bed of roses. And I'd like to share with you, and I think this is what I consider a public service announcement, especially if you're either not married yet or newly married, most marriages, if not the vast majority of marriages, have rocky spots in them. There's a certain point when the young couple wake up, they look at each other and go, we were not meant for each other. It's obvious, it's clear. And they really go through periods. Most marriages go through rocky periods, and most marriages that are successful, that are happy, well-adjusted, good, strong marriages, go through those periods, build, continue growing together, and they create an everlasting true bond of love which gets them through real life. But the key to it is understanding a number of points. Point number one is that while Hashem wants a man and his wife to be happy, Hashem wants them to bond together, there's a lot of work that has to go into that. And the first job of a husband and wife when they get married is to understand each other and to understand that this woman is different than I. She's not just different in the things that she likes, her whole attitude, what she needs, what she's looking for in a relationship, her value system is likely different than me. Meaning, it's not just that she speaks more than I do. It's not just she needs to be attractive and I don't. The entire basis of who she is, what she aspires to, what makes her happy is different than me because we are constructed of different natures. And that step is a very important step to being happily married. Because if you're going to use your own barometer for happiness, your own barometer for life satisfaction and apply it to your wife, you're going to find that nothing that you do pleases her. Nothing I buy her, nothing I do makes her happy. And the reason why is because you're in your world. You're in your world in the language of your species, and you're trying to use your currency to make her happy. And the first thing you have to do is you have to study her world. You have to study her species. You have to study her currency. You have to learn what she values. You have to understand what she needs. And then you could begin meeting those needs. And the second point that needs to be understood is that Hashem wants a husband and wife to bond to each other. This infatuation is an important part of it, but it's just the first step. The second step is giving. And the physical part of a marriage is always an important part. When a couple are together physically, that creates a further bonding, creates a further connection. But at the end of the day, it's a dedication one to another, the devotion to someone else's needs, the dedication to the marriage and the sanctity of the marriage and building it that builds that bond, that creates that everlasting love. And that is something that Hashem wants for a person, and that is something that Hashem created various features in the person for. I rarely plug secular books, and the reason why I have a difficult time plugging a secular book is because oftentimes there are things that are off that are not really Das Torah. But there is a book that's worth reading. John Gray's book, which is the same title as the Shmooze, Men Are From Mars, is a book that's well worth reading. And there are points that are definitely off Das Torah, and not everything he says is emes, but it's valuable reading because what it'll give you is a perspective of a different person's view of life. For a man, you'll get to see a woman's perspective. A woman will get to see a man's perspective, and you'll start to see certain patterns. Now, likely you don't match the man described in his book, nor does your wife or your wife-to-be match the woman described. But when you see how starkly different and you see some of the examples, it starts opening your eyes, and it's a worthy read. And gentlemen, here's really the punchline. Would you like to know why Moshe Rabbeinu had such a different view of these Kalim than did HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You see, Moshe Rabbeinu looked at this mirror and said, wait a minute. What we're dealing with is a very potent, high-powered force. A woman's attractiveness is something that is very, very potent. Used appropriately, it's the glue of a marriage. It pulls the husband close to her. It builds that bond, but it is a very, very high-powered tool. Abused, it is very dangerous. It is a tool for the Yetzer Hara, and if a woman is attractive and she causes other men to look at her, she's going to wreak havoc. And Moshe Rabbeinu said these words, these mirrors are something that a woman uses to make herself more attractive. That's way too dangerous a device to have in the Mishkan. And Hashem answered back one thing. There's one piece of the puzzle, Moshe Rabbeinu, that you're unaware of. You're right. But these particular mirrors were used properly. You see, these mirrors were used by the wives to attract their husbands, to get that union, to create that bond of love, to create the ultimate harmony and peace. Hence, these mirrors are chaviv. They're more precious than any other nedava because they were used 100% appropriately. And the moral of the story is that this entity called attractiveness, this entity called the whole issue called attraction, infatuation, desire, that whole piece is something that's very, very potent. You see, it has a very powerful job to do, to take a man and a woman who are so far apart and bring them together, but not in theory, bring them together in the closest of relationships, bring them together as husband and wife sharing their lives together, to get him to give up his stubbornness, to get her to give up her identity, and to have them create a bond, a union. That has to be a very powerful glue. But that very powerful glue used appropriately is kadosh, is holy. Misused is very disastrously dangerous, and Moshe Rabbeinu was afraid to use it. And Hashem's answer back was only one point. You are correct. But in this case, these mirrors were used appropriately. Hence, it's kadosh, it's holy, the most precious of all the nedavas that are given to the Mishkan. And again, I think this lesson is very important to understand the high-powered fuel that this is. Used appropriately, it creates shalom. Used inappropriately, it destroys. Now I'd like to share an interesting thought with you. For many, many years, I've had the following question. By nature, a woman needs to feel attractive. That's the nature of a woman. Additionally, in a marriage, in a happy, successful marriage, a woman needs to feel cherished, to feel not just loved, but to feel special and cherished. Now, with that as a background, for many, many years, I had the following question. How do you explain a woman taking her husband to the movies? Now, whether it be a drama, a comedy, or a romance, the lights go dim, and all of a sudden the movie starts playing, and there she is, 60 feet tall, gorgeous. Her hair is perfect. Her complexion is absolutely immaculate. The makeup artist spent 3 hours getting every little shading and every nuance, and there she is right there as the music starts playing, the romantic music, and everyone starts melting. Now let me stop for just a moment. If you remember from previous Shmuzim, there is something rather unique about Hollywood. It's not just that they do a very good job of writing the script. There's a very particular job that any movie, to be successful, must fill well. And that's the job of the casting director. The casting director's job it is to find the actor that best plays the part. Now you'll say, why is that such a hard job? Rather easy, right? You have a whole pool of talented actors. Just pick the best one, put them in a part, and boom, what's the big deal to get a casting director who's such a specialist? You see, the answer is, the job of a good actor is not to be a good actor. The job of a good actor is to be a good actor who's believable, so that when he plays the role, he's not just believable, but the crowd, the audience, identifies with the actor. So when he's off running the mile and he's winning the gold medal, it's not he who's winning the medal, but it's you who's identifying with him. It's not he who's climbing the Himalayas, but it's you. And that's what happens in a good movie. Ask your friends. What happens is the actor starts going down a deep, dark alley. The music starts thumpa, thumpa, thumpa. All of a sudden, three thugs jumping up, kick, punch, boom, oh, come on, go, get up, get up, get up. Stop. Take your pulse. You take your pulse at that moment, your heart is racing. And what's going on? It's lights. It's, what are you doing? It's just actors. It's fake blood. What are you getting all bent out of shape for? The answer is it's real. I'm there. I'm in the scene. Because that's good acting. Now, let's go back to the movie theater. where Mrs. So-and-so has taken a husband to watch a nice romance, and the violins are playing, and the actor is falling in love with the gorgeous actress. And what's going on in the head of the wife who took a husband? I guess she's watching a nice romance. But what does she think her husband is thinking about when the actor on the screen is falling madly in love with the beautiful actress? Well, for many years I had the question, "Madam, what are you thinking is going on in your husband's brain when up there, 60 feet tall, larger than life, is this beautiful actress? What about your desire to be attractive to your husband? What about your desire to be cherished?" So I tried to find answers to this question. You ever hear the expression, "Don't ruin a good kasha with a bad teretz"? I'm going to try. I have three answers, and none of them are adequate. None of them properly answer the question. Answer number one, what is a woman thinking is going on in her husband's head? Answer number one is as follows. Granted, there may be women more beautiful than I. I'm not denying it. But my husband is so madly and passionately in love with me that he only has eyes for me. Hence, my beauty to him outshines every actress in Hollywood. Right. All right. Okay, it could be. I don't know, maybe. Okay, let's try answer number two. What is going on in a woman's mind? What is she thinking that's going on in her husband's mind as the movie's playing out? Answer number two is like this. Granted, there may be women who are more beautiful than I. And granted, he may even have eyes for other women. But he's so much in love with me that he would never desire another woman. No. Let's try terrace number three. Granted, there are women more beautiful than I. Granted, my husband may even notice that there are women more beautiful than I. Granted, he may even desire women who are more beautiful than I, but he loves me so that he would never actually think about that. No way, not my husband. No way, I'm secure. Madam, I'd like to be the one to burst your bubble. I'm sorry, I don't think. I've never done a study. I've never climbed into the gentlemen's minds who are in the movie theater, but knowing what I do know about the male race, I don't believe that that's quite what's going on in your husband's head. Now, you may be saying to yourself, why am I discussing this here in a male audience? We should get the women, get the wives here and say, lady, pay attention, get a seismograph into your husband's brain when that gorgeous actress is up there on the... Okay. The truth is, I hope the women will listen to the CD. That's the first thing I hope. I think the husbands may just hide this one. This may become the most unpopular schmooze in North America. But actually, there is a very nogea point. And that point is for men to understand. Would you like to know what really the pshat in a woman, how she could take her husband either to the movies or to watch a nice TV romance or a DVD or whatever, or how she could do these kind of things? It's really quite simple. A woman's nature is very different than is a man's nature. A woman in a good marriage not only bonds with the husband, but actually identifies herself as the husband's wife. Historically, it was Mrs. McGillicuddy, Mrs. Smith. It wasn't just that she married the husband, she became the blacksmith's wife, the doctor's wife. Her identity became subsumed into her husband so that she became a part of the husband, a support, and a literally a chelik of the husband. Because of that, a woman by nature is far more loyal than is a man. A woman in a good marriage, not only does she identify with the husband, but is extremely loyal, has a great level of fidelity because she's bonded to her husband. However, the male species is very different. A husband can be happily married. He could love his wife, and he could still have eyes in many other places. And he could still desire another woman because the nature of a man is different than is the nature of a woman. Even when he's happily married, even when he loves his wife, even when he's bonded, he may find himself looking at things, desiring things that he never wished he desired, that he, believe me, in his wildest dream, he would love to somehow get rid of, but that's when in his nature. And the point is that the nature of man and the nature of woman are different, starkly different by design. And although this is not the point of this particular shmooze, you ever hear people ask like the following question? What's wrong with platonic relationships? Come on, why can't we go out double dates, two couples, four couples? What's wrong? We're just friends. We're just friends, you know? There's nothing going on here. Let's go back to that study for a minute. 3-year-olds boys and girls can be just friends, because there really isn't that much gender identity at that stage. By the way, I have a 2-year-old boy. My 2-year-old boy now plays with trucks all day long. We take him to the window when a fire truck comes up the street, he's like, whoa! I have 4 girls. Not a single one of my girls cared about trucks, nor did I care about them now. So there is gender identity even at 2 years of age. But the bottom line is, at 3, they're able to play one with the other. By 5, only 20% of the boys play with the girls. By 7, there's almost no best friends, because at 7 years of age, there's a very real difference. The girls are playing house, the boys are playing truck, and they're into different worlds. Their worlds don't cross. They don't share the same interests. They don't enjoy the same activities. They're just in different planets. And those planets remain apart until puberty. And then something changes. There's a sudden change, and all of a sudden they're best friends again. And if you'd like to see what I'm describing, watch a bunch of 15-year-old boys and girls in platonic relationships just talking. But somehow when you walk into the room, there's a kind of electricity. You can note when the boys are talking to the girls, there's a charge in the air. You can almost cut it. There's something there. What is it? I can't quite describe it. And why is it that the girls are into such different things? When the girls are amongst the girls are talking about X, Y, and Z, when the boys amongst the boys are talking about A, B, and C, no shaychus, no connection, and all of a sudden they're best friends. Would you like to know the great secret? The great secret is that there is a charge. That charge is that infatuation, that attractiveness, that koach, that strength that Hashem put into the male, into the female, to allow for bonding, to allow for connection, to allow a husband and wife to bond together. And that is a super-powered fuel. It is a very potent energy that will take two people from different worlds and bring them together to allow them to live harmoniously. But if you mess with that very high-powered fuel, you will find that it is a very dangerous game to play. And if you wonder why it is that we live in a society that's teetering on the edge of disaster, the family unit is a non-existent, it's a piece of ancient history. And if you wonder why it is, you don't have to study that far to understand that one of the key tools that Hashem gave for unity, for harmony, for a husband and wife bonding together is being abused. And when you abuse the tool, it wreaks havoc. And that's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu was afraid of. You can't allow these maros, these mirrors cannot be allowed in the Mishkan. It's too dangerous. That's the tool of the Yetzirah. That's the kind of fuel that will cause tremendous unrest. And Hashem's answer back was only one thing. You are correct normally, but when used appropriately, when used properly, it is the most potent, powerful tool. Hence it is Kaddush. When you use that attractiveness, when you use that desire, when you use the physical connection for its proper purpose, it brings shalom bayis, it brings love, and hence it is one of the holiest activities. Hence these mirrors are the most welcome, and that's exactly what Hashem said. And I think it's a tremendous understanding. Men and women are different. Boys do not have DMCs. Boys do not spend 5 hours on the phone, not because they're just not interested, but because their nature is different. They don't need to communicate in the same way that a girl does. A boy does not need to be attractive. He does not need to be cherished. He does not need to attach himself in the same way that a girl does. But the reason why that's key for us to understand is because if you wish to be happily married, you must study your spouse. You must understand that they are coming from a very different place, not because they're mean or ordinary or stubborn, but because by nature, men and women are different. And once you begin understanding that difference, you can begin treating your wife or your husband in the way that they need to be treated. Once you understand the innate needs, the inborn desires, you can begin meeting those needs, and you can begin living in a proper functioning marriage. The desire, the attractiveness is key, it's important, it's a tool that Hashem gave, but it's only with understanding, it's only with working together that the two can bond together and remain that way for eternity. I want to close with a last observation that I think bears thinking about. Imagine that there's a young woman who at 20 years old is very, very attractive, and she looks in the mirror and the sight that she sees is gorgeous. I'm gorgeous. And she's quite pleased with that. Now again, it is important very important to a girl, how she looks. She looks in the mirror and she's quite pleased. What happens to the same woman when she looks in the mirror when she's 30? Now, she'll still be an attractive woman, but a 30-year-old is not quite what a 20-year-old is. What happens when she looks in the mirror when she's 40? You know, a bit of a double chin, there's some sagging, not quite what it used to be. I knew a very personable, very attractive woman. When she turned 50, she would not get out of bed that day. And she had a very rough time, because when you're 50 years old, it's a different game. And suddenly when you're 60, your attractiveness is largely faded. Now, what does a woman do when she's 60 years old and she looks in the mirror? So, if in fact she's been playing the game of attracting the male species, getting honor and accord for my good looks for the past 20 years, 40 years, 50 years, she will have a very rough time looking in that mirror. But I want you to watch the other scenario. Let's say a woman used her attractiveness for what it was given to her. She used it to bring her husband closer. She used it to build a bias. She brought children into the world, maybe at this point grandchildren, and she knows and understands Hashem gave her a tool. She used that tool for its given purpose. She created a bond of love that's real and vibrant. With that attractiveness, she was given a tool and she used it. I believe that that is a great comforting thought. And it's a whole lot easier for a woman to look in the mirror and know that she was given this, used it appropriately, and is now enjoying the benefits. And there's a flip side to this. Men do not need to be attractive, but men have different needs. Typically, a man needs to feel competent, to feel he can do, he can accomplish, he can do things. What happens to a man when he hits 60 and he says to himself, made some money, spent that money, made some more money, spent that too, and here I am, getting on in age and not a whole lot more to go. Where's my resourcefulness? Where's my energy? Where's my accomplishments? And my friends, here's the punchline. When a person looks in the mirror at 40, at 60, and they say to themselves, I've used my talents and my energies properly. I'm getting old, that's true. But what I've left behind me is a wake of accomplishments, of great deeds, great things. There's a sense of empowerment. There's a sense of satisfaction. Because in fact, Hashem gave that person a tool, and that tool was used appropriately, and that person has a very great, deep sense of satisfaction. But if a person looks in that mirror with any other understanding, whether it's as a woman looking on with wrinkles, whether it's a man with a sense of power leaving him, it brings to a great sense of depression. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the human to be happy, husband and wife to be happy together. Hashem made various forces, gave us various tools, and ultimately Hashem wants a human being to be successful. Successful means to set goals, to have a mission, to have a purpose, and living that mission and that purpose to gain great satisfaction. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom and understanding to be able to put this into practice, to live happily, to live b'shalom.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozing free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.